BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. We're exploring Belfast this week by way of two new novels set at different moments of 20th century conflict. As the war in Ukraine continues, we consider the situation faced by dissident writers from Russia, and we look at the changing status of a category of character more often than not mocked and pitied in fiction, the spinster.
They were the leftover jigsaw pieces, their untidy presence making the characters around them feel uncomfortable.
When we mention the Blitz, the first thought many of us have is of London, Liverpool or Glasgow, forgetting the terrible devastation suffered by the docks and residential areas of Belfast in 1941. Lucy Caldwell's new novel, These Days, tells the story of two sisters whose lives are transformed forever by four nights of bombing. Audrey is engaged to be married to a promising young doctor, while Emma is in a passionate relationship with another woman. Both stay in the city, while thousands of others flee.
Driving back from North Belfast, they saw the exodus. Cars, carts, bicycles, perambulators, bath chairs, even children's bogey carts. Anything with wheels had been pressed into service, loaded with human and material flotsam, leaving the city. The rag and bone men, the coke men, the old fellas with their ice cream trikes, the woman that sells hourglass herrings door to door from the panniers in the back of her donkey, all of them seemed to have taken to the roads, belongings tied up hastily in scattered parcels. Others trailed boxes with rope, like cart horses themselves, or had pillowcases slung over their shoulders or shawls tied to their backs, stuffed with, who knows, family photo albums, tins of luncheon meat, loaves of bread.
Louise Kennedy's novel, Trespasses, is set during the Troubles. In the pub owned by her family, Catholic primary school teacher Kushla meets the Protestant barrister Michael at a time of sectarian violence so appalling that the Blitz is remembered almost with affection.
Michael had pulled his stool beside Jimmy's and was smiling as the old man made chop-chop karate motions as if he was single-handedly taking on a battalion of Japanese soldiers. Older people loved to talk about the war, especially the Blitz. Belfast endured the worst single night of bombing outside of London, but it was more than that. The doodlebugs had been non-sectarian. They could talk about that war because this war was unspeakable.
These Days is the fourth novel by Lucy Caldwell, who is the winner of the 2021 BBC Short Story Award. Louise Kennedy is also an acclaimed writer of short stories, and Trespasses is her first novel. Both have roots in and around Belfast, and both are here to talk about their new books. Louise on the line from Sligo, and Lucy in person. Lucy, the facts of the Belfast Blitz are undoubtedly dramatic, but so too are the relationships that affect the sisters at the heart of the book. What's at stake for Emma and Audrey when we join them at the start of the novel?
When the novel begins, the way that Audrey thinks of it is that her life is moving along a predestined groove. She's engaged to be married. She's marrying a doctor like her father. She knows exactly the life that she'll have. And then what the Blitz does is it disrupts everything. Suddenly everything is provisional. Nothing can be taken for granted. And in that, Audrey finds a freedom to question all of her choices, really. Emma, at the start of the novel, is volunteering at the first aid post. And she really comes into herself over the course of the Blitz. In the course of my research, I was looking at all these photographs of women, and I was thinking of the roles that women had to play at this time of war on the home front and the freedoms that they would have had that otherwise, again, their lives might have gone on in those predestined grooves, and they wouldn't have had the chance to be in those situations, to be in the city, to live like that, to behave like that.
Would you read a short scene featuring Emma and her lover, Sylvia?
As they walked on to the next case and the next and on into the next gallery, she imagined seeing them from the outside, as others must. A woman in a tweed jacket and trousers and a slightly bashed up felt hat, and a younger, taller, hatless girl with a scarf that doesn't suit her auburn hair at all and trousers that are too small for her. And she wondered, did people think them friends or a tutor and pupil or even, this morning's giggle rose again, an aunt and niece or godmother in charge? And she suddenly thought that people don't think. They barely glance at two women. They don't wonder. And in this invisibility is a new prospect of freedom too, that you can, in fact, walk the city as yourself and no one knows or cares to.
Louise, Kushla, the 24-year-old schoolteacher at the heart of your book, begins an affair with a married man, a Protestant barrister. Just how dangerous a situation is Kushla in, and does she realise what she's getting herself into?
I suppose in the north of Ireland at that time, there was some mixing. And the town that I've set the novel in is on the shores of Belfast Lough, and Kushla's family have a bar. And the town is probably about 90% Protestant. And I mean, obviously, everybody knows that they're Catholic, but there's a sort of unspoken contract, which is that they sort of have to be sort of quiet about their identity and not rub anybody's nose in it. And at the time, there's a lot of sectarian tension and a fairly fine line has to be tread in the sort of conversation that they have, you know, behind the bar. And I suppose when Michael comes in, she knows what she's getting herself into. But pretty much straight away, they meet under a pretext of her sort of teaching Irish to his friends, like some sort of strange hobby that they have or something. So, yeah, I mean, I guess she knows pretty quickly what she's getting herself into.
Yeah, there are deep secrets in both these books. Lucy, how did you go about recreating the Belfast of the early 40s?
There's very little fiction about the Belfast Blitz. There's one novel by Brian Moore called The Emperor of Ice Cream, and the Blitz features a bit in Mary Beckett's novel, Give Them Stones. But apart from that, it's barely there in the fiction of the city at all. But the thing is, it is still just about within living memory. My grandma died. She had some stories. I wish I'd listened to them more before she died. But my dad has stories still of his uncles, you know, running up the mountain to collect the shrapnel from planes. And what you realise is that so many people, when you start talking to them, they do have a story. And there is an incredible wealth of testimony. The historian Brian Barton has a sort of 1,000-page magisterial work of a lifetime collecting so much of this testimony. Stephen Dowds as well has a really good introduction to the Belfast Blitz through newspapers, diary extracts, mass observation diaries. And so woven in are real stories, true stories, real people's diaries, his daily lives I wove into the novel as well.
Louise, Trespassers is set several decades after the period Lucy was just describing, but it's still nearly 50 years in the past. What was your method for capturing the Belfast of that time?
I think from the outset, I was concerned about making it as authentic as possible because I was born in the north and I lived there until I was 12. And I have really strong memories of growing up there and of lots of things that happened. You know, my family, the story is completely a work of fiction, but the pub is very, very like the pub that my grandmother owned in the 70s. And the town is very like the one that I grew up in lots of ways. I mean, I read books. I know Anna Byrne said this, that in the years after she left Belfast, she spent, you know, a long time reading about the Troubles to try and get her head around it. And I think a lot of people have done that because it just sort of gives a perspective, something to be able to step away. And I think as well, maybe it needed some time. But I spoke to my family a lot, my parents especially, and aunts and uncles, and asked them to confirm facts for me. But those were always really quite unreliable, you know, were kind of unhelpful conversations because, you know, if you get a family around a table and talk about an incident, every single person will have a different memory. So that wasn't really helpful. And I suppose I just had to rely, maybe not just on my memory, but I probably did what I did with my short stories, which was to use details about what people wore and what the place smelled like and looked like and what people ate and that sort of thing. And things that I remember, you know, about, you know, bits of graffiti that I saw, you know, from the backseat of a car when we went to visit my granny up the Crumlin Road, that sort of thing.
That's right. And I suppose if your family all has a different perspective of something, that gives you space as a novelist to get inside and use your imagination too, which you do wonderfully when you're describing how the Troubles kind of permeates every aspect of life, even for children at school. Could you read a short scene?
Before lessons, they did the news. Kushla hated doing the news, but the headmaster insisted. He said it encouraged the children to be aware of the world around them. Kushla thought they already knew too much about the world around them. Davy stood up, always the first to volunteer. His red jumper was dark with damp at the shoulders and neckline. There was a bomb in Belfast, he said. He says that every day, said Jonathan, who sat beside him. Well, today he's right. Thank you, Davy, said Kushla. Jonathan got to his feet. It wasn't in Belfast, he said. A booby-trap bomb that was intended for a British Army foot patrol exploded prematurely, killing two boys near the border. They died instantly. Booby-trap, incendiary device, gelignite, nitroglycerine, petrol bomb, rubber bullets, sarracen, internment, the Special Powers Act, Vanguard, the vocabulary of a seven-year-old child now.
It's powerful and chilling stuff. Thank you, Louise. As women, did either of you feel conscious that it was unusual to be writing about conflict and violence, which is so often a male preserve? How about you, Lucy? There are obviously great novels of war written by women, by Olivia Manning, and you mentioned that Mary Beckett's book sort of touches on the Blitz. I suppose for you it felt you were more conscious that, well, no one's really written about this to any great extent.
Yeah, so it did feel, I was responding to Bria Moore's novel a bit, but it did feel, you know, I just finished writing the short stories in Multitudes and Intimacies, all of which deal with interior lives of women. And one of the characters I was most interested in is the character of Doreen Bates in my novel. And she is a real person, who a tax inspector who was posted to Belfast in the Blitz in 1941. And she was pregnant at the time. She was unmarried. She was in love with her older boss, had been for about a decade. And she's pregnant. She has twins. And her diaries are extraordinary. I think they should be one of the most read, most celebrated chronicles of the 20th century. And she talks about being a tax inspector. She talks about war. She talks about the colour of the nail varnish she's wearing and her lipstick. She talks about her clothes. She talks about how to get around the practical difficulties of being an unmarried pregnant mother, and how there are lots of ways in which people want to help you and they will turn a blind eye. And so for me, yes, it's always telling those women's stories. There's a phrase that Doreen has in her diaries that I use in my novel. And she says people have public selves, private selves and secret selves. And I love that. And I love the idea of the interplay between all of those different layers and levels and what we show to others and what we don't even dare admit to ourselves. And so those, yeah, secret lives of women was something I was really interested in writing.
Louise, how about you?
No, I think like everything else to do with my writing is because I think I haven't been at it long enough to know any better. So I just kind of do things and presume it's OK. And I'm just waiting for people to tell me otherwise. I guess a lot of my experience of it and the experience of a lot of people would have been just how my mother managed to, you know, get hold of powdered milk during the Ulster Workers' Council strike, or how she had to negotiate roadblocks in our joint when we were on our way up to visit my granny and stuff like that. So a lot of it, you know, in the conflicts in the north, there was probably a relatively small number of people who were actively involved in what was happening, and everyone else was just trying to find a way to navigate the various kind of challenges that threw up. But I suppose a lot of it was really, especially from the point of view of women, was about trying to keep home life quite normal and to keep things running, which was at times like really quite bizarre, you know. But yet they did it. So I think, that's probably definitely the sort of story that I'm interested in.
Now, you're both garlanded short story writers. Lucy, you won the BBC National Short Story Award last year. Louise, you've been shortlisted 2 years on the trot for the Sunday Times Short Story Award. Mm-hmm. And it didn't escape my notice that in both your novels, you reference short stories. Louise, you mentioned the collection Dool by Liam O'Flaherty, an Irish word mm-hmm. meaning desire, I think. Mm-hmm. And Lucy, you give one of your characters the gift of reading Catherine Ann Porter's great story, Rope. Were these ways of perhaps, you know, telling the short story that you haven't forgotten about it?
I think dool is probably one of my favourite words in any language, and I wanted to get that in there. But I do love Liam O'Flaherty's stories, and I love that collection. It's one that Irish people are kind of force-fed short stories in secondary school, and those were the Irish language short stories that we had to read. And I think dool, it means a bit more than desire. It's a word that there's no exact equivalent for, so it sort of means longing. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the short story thing is always there. I think even as I wrote the novel, I was kind of just about like, what am I writing here? Because I hadn't attempted one before, and it just seemed to be kind of insanely long, and it was a very different approach that I'd have from writing the short stories as well. I don't know. I think I just for most of the writing of it, I was kind of surprised that that's what I was doing, you know.
How about you, Lucy?
Yeah, I hadn't written a novel for my last novel was about a decade ago. I've only been writing short stories. Partly when lockdown began, I've mainly looked after my young children for the past while. And when lockdown began, my husband and I divided our childcare evenly. So I suddenly had every morning, we divided the day. I had mornings, he had afternoons. So I was writing. I was writing every single morning for 6 mornings. And sometimes on the seventh morning, the day of rest, he would say, look, you're so antsy, just go and do a few hours on your novel. You know, we'll all be happier for it. And so suddenly I feel I had the time. But also there was something about short stories they're so brilliant at Seán Ó Fuaileann talks about a short story as, compared to the novel's jumbo jet, a short story is a hot air balloon. It can ascend to vertiginous heights, but it can carry very few people. Short stories would do things very differently. They might do things brilliantly, but this story needed the space and time and range of a novel.
Thank you both. Lucy Caldwell's These Days is published by Faber and Louise Kennedy's Trespasses by Bloomsbury. Both those novels break free of traditional happy ever after pairings. Long overdue, you might say, not least because such endings have, in the past, tended to relegate a whole category of humanity, unmarried women, to losers in the game of life. But according to the writer Emma John, the role of the spinster in fiction is now, at last, changing.
The word spinster left official use in 2005, when it was finally dropped from the marriage certificate. And if the concept still lingers, we can thank the English novel. Nowhere else do we see the single woman more traduced or vilified. For centuries, literature mocked and pitied her in a way that created as many social prejudices as it reflected. Are we finally about to see a change in narrative? Spinsters rarely got to be the central character of a novel unless, like Jane Eyre or Bridget Jones, they finished it by finding a partner. The true spinster, the one who stayed single to the end of the story, was almost always cast in a supporting role, and never a flattering one at that. She was either a pathetic figure offering a tragic reminder of what happened to women who didn't make themselves attractive enough, like the nervous, prattling Miss Bates in Emma, or she was a twisted, man-hating antagonist, like Great Expectations' Miss Havisham or David Copperfield's Miss Murdstone. In fact, Charles Dickens was so good at vilifying spinsters that sometimes he made them both, like Miss Wade in Little Dorrit. "Consider what is in that lady's heart and think what a future lies before you," Mr. Meagles warns his servant Tattycoram when she leaves with Miss Wade to live a life of her own. From the earliest days of the novel, spinsters were awkward outsiders in a form dominated by the marriage plot. They were the leftover jigsaw pieces, their untidy presence making the characters around them feel uncomfortable. It took a brave and far-seeing writer to turn society's lazy stereotype on its head. Elizabeth Gaskell did it in Cranford by creating a self-contained female world where men were considered vulgar. George Gissing did it in his extraordinarily empathetic 1893 work, The Odd Women, where we find ourselves actively cheering for a heroine as she turns her suitor down. Throughout the 20th century, spinster protagonists remained as radical as they were rare, but that only made them increasingly powerful figures, like Sylvia Townsend Warner's eponymous Lolly Willows, who sells her soul to the devil rather than put up with a woman's domestic lot. But more importantly, they became ever more relatable. Mildred, the narrator of Barbara Pym's Excellent Women, even warns the reader in chapter one, "I am not at all like Jane Eyre, who must have given hope to so many plain women who tell their stories in the first person." As Mildred is quick to point out, for most of us, life is more mundane. The small unpleasantnesses rather than the great tragedies, the little useless longings rather than the great renunciations and dramatic love affairs of history or fiction. It turns out, in fact, that the spinster was playing the long game. The golden age of single women in literature has arrived. Authors are turning romantic fiction on its head, creating heroines like Candice Carty-Williams's eponymous Queenie, or Nina in Radhika Sangani's 30 Things I Love About Myself, or Vivian in City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert, who all reach the end of their novels having discovered the freedom to be themselves, independent of romantic relationships. Others, like Gail Honeyman, creator of Eleanor Oliphant, and Patrick Cottrell, author of Sorry to Disturb the Peace, have focused on single female protagonists who aren't looking for love in the first place. Or rather, it's self-love or familial love that they're seeking. It's taken a long time for the novel to reach the stage where a heroine embracing singlehood constitutes a happy ending. But instead of spinsters fading out of literature, they're finally coming to claim it. Reader, I didn't marry him.
Emma John, Her memoir, Self-Contained, Scenes from a Single Life, has just been published in paperback. You're listening to Open Book with me, Chris Power, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Now, how do you read your way into and around the tragedy of the war in Ukraine? There's a mass of great journalism, of course, but what about other types of writing? Andrei Kurkov, perhaps the best-known Ukrainian novelist outside his own country, has been speaking on Radio 4 in his letters from Ukraine. On this programme, Elizabeth Day recently presented a reader's guide to the country's most famous historic literary son, Nikolai Gogol. Our thoughts are primarily with the people and writers of Ukraine, but what of dissident Russian writers? How are they continuing to live their lives within Russia and increasingly outside it as refugees? Sasha Dugdale is a distinguished translator from Russian. Her work, including Maria Stepanova's genre-hopping memoir In Memory of Memory, which was shortlisted for the 2021 International Booker Prize. Sasha came into the studio to discuss the plight of such writers.
Talking about Russian culture and Russian literature right at the moment is difficult and even hurtful to many Ukrainians. So I want to say that before I talk a little bit about some of the dissident writing I've come into contact with in Russia. But it feels really important to me that we listen to those voices and we hear them, because they are the future. They're the side of Russia that we need to be in contact with and listening to. And I think it's also really important to remember that Russian propaganda, pro-Putin propaganda, is not a recent development. It's not connected with the war. It's been incrementally building up over 20 years. And the Russians have a phrase for this. They say the screws are being turned. And the screws are being turned, have been turned and turned over the period of Putin's rule. I can give a really good example of this. I've worked a lot in theatre and theatre writing. And at the beginning of the 2000s, a very small, very plucky, independent Moscow theatre was set up called Theatre Doc. And it was dedicated to new writing by playwrights who wanted to talk about authentic life, who wanted to talk about what real Russians were experiencing, not just Russians, the whole space, the whole region. So at that theatre, they put on shows about the sinking of the Kursk submarine, about women in penal colonies, about the mothers of soldiers who had died in Chechnya, and more recently about the protests that were happening in Russia. And as they started tackling those themes, the theatre started to experience repression, policemen coming to the theatre, enormous fines, being forced to move from one venue to the next, day-long interrogations for the founders of that theatre. And a couple of years ago, the two founders of the theatre, two immensely brave people, Mikhail Ugarov and Yelena Gremina, died within a month of each other. 2 decades of slow repression and slow persecution. And at the end of it, this war, the two things are intimately connected. I really have the sense that there's just these voices coming out of the darkness and reaching me.
And how do writers who are either having their work performed within Russia or published within Russia, how does it work in terms of censorship? Is there someone sort of reviewing this work and commenting on things they want removed, or is there sort of soft pressure put on publishers? How does it work in a practical way?
It's very cynical and very sly. So there have been a number of censorship laws. One of the really strange ones was that you have to give your material, any published material, an age-appropriate guideline. And it's very easy to fall foul of that and for the work to be confiscated, to be taken back.
OK, a certificate like a film would have.
That's
in this
right,
country.
Yes. And of course, if you know, everyone's just gone for 18, because if you make a mistake, then there are many homophobic censorship laws, there are pro-patriotism guidelines. But actually, the kind of levers are more subtle. They're about, for example, people being charged with embezzlement of funds, for example, or some kind of fraud, and that being the way to censor organisations.
And are there any absolute red lines? Like, if you're, from your knowledge of translating Russian writers, what would really not make its way into a Russian work of literature?
My feeling is that Russian censorship is pretty chaotic, and it also depends very much on audience. So Theatre Doc, for example, became challenged by the regime when they started having huge audiences for a play about a protest movement. Poetry is much less popular, much less read, and I'd be surprised if there wasn't was anything you couldn't say in poetry. For example, at the moment there is a lot of anti-war poetry on Facebook.
That's interesting. I'm always thinking of the book, but of course literature can survive across multiple platforms.
Yeah, I think we have very old-fashioned notions of how censorship operates, and they're mainly black and white film visions of somebody with a stamp, you know, and a red stamp, and that's not how it really operates. It's these really cynical little levers, you know.
It's fascinating. Well, thank you, Sasha, for such an illuminating description of the scene in Russia. Before we end, I did want to ask if you were going to suggest one or two writers I and our listeners could go away and read to kind of widen our knowledge of the current Russian scene, who would you recommend and why?
The writer I translate, Maria Stepanova, who wrote the prose book In Memory of Memory, has a poetry collection which is in English translation called The War of the Beasts and the Animals. And the title poem for this collection was written as the war in Donbass started. And it's really about the way that culture enables a people to turn into an aggressor. It's about the way that culture, films, literature, all sorts of other forms of culture come together to create an atmosphere in which war, the struggle, the sacrificial death, the great victory are all possible. And I think it's a really important text for our time. And for a prose account of the individual struggle against state-sponsored violence throughout the history in the Russian-speaking regions, you can't really beat Svetlana Alexievich's books. Secondhand Time is just brilliant and devastating. And it hasn't really ceased to be relevant. It's exactly what people are still experiencing.
Thank you, Sasha Dugdale. Sasha's translation of Maria Stepanova's In Memory of Memory is published by Fitzcarraldo. You can find details of the book she recommended and much else besides on the Open Book website. And on next week's Open Book, Elizabeth Day will be talking to the Booker-winning author Douglas Stewart about his new novel, Young Mungo, and exploring the creative landscape of Oxford between the wars with historian Daisy Dunn.